on June 24th, 2022, just after 8 a.m. in Wisconsin. Breaking news.
The Supreme Court has reached a decision on the landmark Roe v. Wade case. The ruling is on a case called Dobbs.
Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court case from 1973 that ruled the Constitution protected the right to an abortion, had been overturned. In Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers, a Democrat, condemned the decision in a video.
Folks, our worst fears have been confirmed. The Supreme Court has stripped the right to choose from millions of Americans.
And others celebrated it, like Julaine Appling, who runs the anti-abortion group Wisconsin Family Action.
We are rejoicing in the goodness of God in giving us a court that understands that this was a decision that was wrongly made in 1973. But folks, we have worked.
Soon, protesters started gathering at the state capitol.
Free abortion on demand!
And that morning, Tanya Atkinson of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, which ran three of the state's four abortion clinics, announced that it would have to abide by the state's abortion law from the 1800s, which was once again in force.
Because that law was not repealed, because that law remains in effect, today, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin has been forced to temporarily suspend abortion services.
But what is that law? How did we get to that point? And what does it mean going forward? I'm Bridget Bowden.
And I'm Brady Carlson. This is How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case meant that any state laws that had been blocked by the Roe v. Wade ruling were valid again, including the law in Wisconsin.
And the state has seen big changes because of it. There have been virtually no legal abortions for more than a year now. Anyone in Wisconsin who wants an abortion has to cross state lines, and providers are traveling too.
Just a few days after that day in June 2022, Wisconsin's Attorney General, Josh Call, filed a lawsuit seeking to repeal Wisconsin's abortion ban. It's expected that the state Supreme Court will take up that lawsuit sometime this fall.
To understand that challenge and where we are today, you have to understand what the law actually is and what's happened since it was first put on the books. So let's go back to the year it was first written.
1849.
The 1849 ban.
That 1849 ban on abortion.
The 1849 law.
1849.
Just 1 year after Wisconsin became a state, lawmakers banned abortion. And more than 174 years later, a version of that ban is still on the books.
But 1849 was a different time. Thomas Edison's light bulb was still three decades away. The biggest issue in the United States was slavery, not abortion. And of course, women did not have the right to vote.
And the way that people thought about abortion was different, too. First of all, there were no pregnancy tests. The only way to prove someone was pregnant was when they felt the baby move.
That's called quickening. Before quickening, you might be pregnant, but you wouldn't really know. Or you might reasonably think you were pregnant, but you didn't want to be. So either way, you would pursue one of a number of remedies.
Home medical journals sometimes had instructions for ending a pregnancy, or what they would call restoring the menses.
So people would use combinations of, you know, tansy or rue or quinine or even castor oil. And in the right combination and at the right strength, there are these sort of herbal remedies that can induce contractions that can bring on effectively like a miscarriage.
That's UW Green Bay history professor Kimberly Riley. She says it wasn't always spelled out in clear language, like this will end your pregnancy.
But then they would say something like, It remedies the most serious form of female complaint. It allows you to expel in an early stage a tumor from the womb. And so everybody would know what you meant by, well, you know, what was meant by tumor.
And since there was no legal or medical way to know whether someone was pregnant before quickening, Wisconsin's original abortion ban only made it illegal after quickening.
Many states passed laws like this in the 1840s, reflecting this idea that abortions before quickening weren't crimes. But the driving force behind those laws was really different from what motivates activists today.
It's almost impossible for Americans today to think of abortion as an issue
that was not tied to religion.
That's James Moore. He's a historian who wrote the book Abortion in America.
But in the 19th century, it was not tied very closely anyway to religion. That is, it was a medical question. It was not a religious or a moral question.
To be sure, there were people in this time who wanted to ban abortion for religious reasons, such as a belief that life begins at conception. But Moore says the main push for these bans came from doctors who were trying to professionalize their field.
Medicine had long been a mix of skilled professionals, hacks, and people who were outright selling unproven and sometimes dangerous treatments. While some of these at-home abortion methods might have worked, others may have been toxic or simply ineffective.
So the push to pass state laws banning abortions wasn't a hot-button issue that the public was passionate about. There weren't big protests for or against abortion rights, and there weren't big headlines in the newspapers.
These were not public campaigns. They were campaigns conducted by elite physicians who had the ear of legislatures and were able to suggest that this was necessary legislation.
In Wisconsin, one such elite physician was William Henry Brisbane, who also happened to be the clerk of the state Senate.
Brisbane was also a pastor and an abolitionist. He wrote prolifically about some of the political issues he cared about and corresponded with a national leader in the anti-abortion movement at the time. In one of his letters, Brisbane said he wanted to take the word quick out of Wisconsin's abortion law.
It is my present intention to endeavor to get a law passed by our legislature to meet the case, much too common, of administering drugs and injections either to prevent conception or destroy the embryo.
In 1858, the legislature did exactly that. And in another letter, Brisbane claimed the credit for pushing that change through. After that, anybody who tried to terminate a pregnancy at any stage was breaking state law. And that's the ban we have today.
But Brisbane knew that the ban would probably not lead to many people being convicted of illegal abortions. He wrote as much in his letters.
It is not probable that any law could be enforced in such cases.
And he was right, because going forward, the near-total abortion ban was not very total in practice.
For more than a century, abortion continued, and very few people were ever prosecuted for it. And even the state medical society, which had backed the ban, acknowledged illegal abortion was still happening regularly.
A researcher who surveyed available county court records from 1849 to 1900 found only 17 prosecutions related to abortion during those 50 years. Of those 17, only 5 were found guilty.
That procedure is sort of inherently a very private, personal one, right? And so in order to find out that it has happened, you need people to tell you, to tell law enforcement.
That's Marquette University law professor Lisa Mazey. She said people were definitely still having abortions, but as long as no one admitted to being involved, then police and prosecutors wouldn't have evidence that an abortion had taken place.
And without that evidence, they couldn't prosecute. So the law was really only enforced in cases where someone died or almost died, like in this case from 1933, described in the Wisconsin State Journal.
A 25-year-old Madison woman and her brother were held in the Dane County Jail Saturday night while the district attorney's office and Madison police investigated the death of Miss Elizabeth Ripp, 25, Wanakee, a maid in a Madison home, from the effects of an alleged illegal operation. Miss Ripp died about 8 p.m. Saturday night.
First, note how newspapers in the early 20th century don't use the term abortion. They only say illegal operation.
Before she died, Elizabeth Ripp spoke to police and implicated her boyfriend's sister, Lily Cordio, or as the papers called her, Mrs. Joseph Cordio.
Right away, Cordio admitted she had told Ripp how to end a pregnancy, but she said she had also told Ripp it was dangerous. She said Ripp came to her house, went into her bathroom, and a few minutes later came out and announced that she had done it.
The authorities found medical instruments in Cordio's home, though at that time, a woman could order dilation instruments and vaginal probes from the Sears catalog or any drugstore, and they were used to treat other health issues.
Eventually, Cordio was convicted of advising Ripp on how to perform the abortion and was sentenced to 6 months in county jail.
As surgical practice advanced, more women sought surgical abortions. One of them was Hazel Williamson.
The 34-year-old was a farmer's daughter. She was active in the Wanakee Women's Club and one of many women working in a factory during World War II. And in 1943, she was also 2 to 5 months pregnant. Her fiancé gave her a list of 3 doctors, and she chose the first name on the list.
Dr. Edmund W. Tim, 68, Milwaukee, was bound over to Milwaukee Municipal Court Thursday on a charge of second-degree manslaughter in connection with the death, June 15, of Hazel Williamson, 34, Wanakee, after an alleged illegal operation.
According to news reports like this one from the Wisconsin State Journal, Tim sent Williamson to what was called a lying-in home, used by people seeking an abortion. The initial operation was performed at his office.
A witness later testified Williamson said Tim was, quote, like a horse doctor, and that his operation hurt her. That evening, she started running a fever. 2 days later, Tim performed a second procedure on Williamson. Early the next morning, she died from sepsis and a uterine hemorrhage.
Tim arrived at the lying-in home shortly after Williamson's death, and before he called the coroner, he went through her purse to find that list of doctors and ripped his name off the top. Eventually, he was charged with second-degree manslaughter and found guilty.
The Williamson case came at a time when prosecutors were broadly concerned with pushing the nation back toward traditional gender roles. That's according to Lauren McIver-Thompson. She's a history professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia who studies birth control and abortion in the 20th century.
They're lumping in illegal abortion alongside all kinds of illicit sex, whether it's, you know, same-sex sex or heterosexual sex outside of marriage. And so that's really important to think about holistically.
At one point, the state had a set of statutes related to abortion cataloged under offenses against chastity, morality, and decency. That's the law that prosecutors used to charge Lily Cordio in 1933, not the abortion law itself. By 1955, the state legislature eliminated the morality laws and clarified that a, quote, unborn child meant a human being from the time of conception.
As the state tightened its restrictions on abortion, society's views were changing. Some women and doctors were openly saying that if abortion was in someone's best interest, they should be able to access it.
By the 1960s, grassroots campaigns to legalize abortion were growing all over the country. In the late 60s, Edie Ryan was a stay-at-home mom living in suburban Whitefish Bay. She founded the Wisconsin Committee to Legalize Abortion and started speaking about the issue on radio and TV. That's how she gained a public profile.
I started getting phone calls from people saying, asking if they knew, if I knew where to get an abortion, and I didn't know. And then one day I got a phone call from somebody anonymous who gave me a phone number and said, you can give this phone number and people can get abortions.
When she was interviewed by the Milwaukee Sentinel in 1970, Ryan told a reporter that she never told women how to do anything illegal. But she says now that she used to send women to doctors who secretly performed abortions.
I was on the telephone a lot, and my 9-year-old used to pick up on it, and she used to imitate me, and she'd say, how far along are you?
But the calls themselves were serious.
A lot of the women who called would say to me, I have so many kids, I can't deal with another one. And my husband will not use birth control. And, you know, they couldn't get birth control for themselves.
In 1969, one of the doctors Ryan referred women to was arrested. And that doctor's case had implications for the future of abortion in the state.
On a Saturday in September 1969, a 23-year-old grad student walked into a doctor's office in downtown Milwaukee.
She paid Dr. Sidney Babbitts $900 in cash, and Babbitts gave her an abortion. Later, Babbitts took the elevator with the woman down to the lobby. A police officer was there, waiting for them.
Michael McCann was Milwaukee County's newly elected district attorney at the time.
A woman was stopped coming out of that office and inquired about whether she had an abortion, confirmed that she'd had an abortion, and I don't think she was ever charged.
She wasn't charged, but she appeared in a Milwaukee County courtroom that same afternoon. McCann needed the woman's testimony so he could get a search warrant for Babbitt's office. That allowed police to recover evidence and eventually to place Babbitt's under arrest.
In the court transcript, the woman initially declines to answer any questions. Then the judge gives her immunity from prosecution. She describes how Babbitt's used dilation and curettage to terminate her pregnancy at about 9 weeks.
McCann, a lifelong Democrat, is now in his 80s. He's also a devout Catholic. He's open about how his faith informs his opposition to issues, including abortion.
I have a deep respect for human life and a suspicion that whenever human life is diminished, there's a price paid for it.
To McCann, the case seemed straightforward. Wisconsin had banned abortions for more than 100 years, and he had evidence that Babbitt's had performed an abortion.
But in the end, things got more complicated. Babbitt sued the state, and a panel of three federal judges took up the case. That forced the state to defend the abortion law itself.
The issue became, you know, what were her rights? Did she have a right to have an abortion? If she had a right to have an abortion, then Babbitt had not violated the law by giving her an abortion.
Edie Rhine's abortion rights group submitted a brief in the Babbitt's case. It argued Wisconsin's abortion ban violated a new precedent set by a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling called Griswold v. Connecticut.
In that 1965 decision, the court ruled that there was a right to contraceptives for married couples because there was a right to privacy in the Constitution. Historian Dave Garrow says attorneys used that same right to privacy to argue for abortion rights in cases including Babbitt's and eventually Roe.
Roe v. Wade was by no means a singular case. There were dozens and dozens of these cases, including Babbitt's from Wisconsin, from all around the country.
And in 1970, the federal judges hearing the Babbitt's case agreed. They found that the right to privacy lasted up until quickening, or when a pregnant person feels fetal movement. That's usually about 4 months into pregnancy. The ruling effectively struck down part of the law that had been in place in Wisconsin since the mid-19th century.
But while the appeals process played out, the judges let McCann and the state attorney general keep trying to prosecute Babbitt's.
For years, Babbitt's case was tied up in appeals. But eventually, the dispute over Wisconsin's abortion ban became moot after a decision with national consequences. Roe v. Wade.
What happened in Wisconsin after Roe, after the break.
Their lives were uprooted when they fled Cuba for the United States in 1980. Thousands of these exiles were sent to Fort McCoy, and then some settled down in Wisconsin. Join me, Maureen McCollum, and co-host Omar Granados as we explore the stories of Cuban refugees who made Wisconsin home. That's in the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted, now available on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more at WPR.org/uprooted.
On January 22, 1973, there was a new decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government.
Roe v. Wade made 46 state abortion bans unenforceable, including the 19th century one in Wisconsin.
But it was still a law. At no time did Wisconsin's legislature repeal the state's near-total abortion ban. Remember what Planned Parenthood's Tanya Atkinson said right after the Dobbs decision in 2022.
Because that law was not repealed, because that law remains in effect, today, Planned Parenthood Wisconsin has been forced to temporarily suspend abortion services.
For over a century after it was written, that law was rarely enforced. And then Roe v. Wade meant it couldn't be enforced.
In a way, that law, to ban nearly all abortions in Wisconsin, has only actually stopped nearly all abortions since 2022.
So why didn't Wisconsin repeal its ban after the Roe ruling? What happened in the 49 years in between Roe and Dobbs? The answer is in part that the world of abortion politics was vastly different 50 years ago. For example, just 5 years after the U.S. Supreme Court issued its Roe v. Wade decision, there was an effort in the Wisconsin legislature to restrict the use of Medicaid funds for abortions.
Some of this debate unfolded the way you might imagine, like protests that erupted in the assembly gallery.
The sergeant will clear the gallery. The sergeant will clear the galleries.
Or inflammatory speeches from lawmakers.
This doesn't close the door to these goody-goods that want to have their good times and then say, oh, we made a mistake, and now you got to come and help me out.
A Democratic governor, Martin Schreiber, vetoed the bill.
I know for sure that a pregnant woman is a human being, a person. I, in my own mind, do not know when a fetus becomes a human being, a person.
And the legislature felt so strongly about the issue that they tried to override that veto.
But the similarities between this abortion debate in 1978 and the way it's discussed today stop there, because it was a Democratic supermajority in the legislature pushing for abortion restrictions. And if it weren't for a handful of Republicans who supported access to abortion, the override would have worked.
Republican Representative Sheehan Donahue opposed the bill from the floor of the Wisconsin Assembly.
This is not an easy vote for anyone. Ladies and gentlemen, what you do here today, you will have to live with the rest of your lives.
And Donahue still remembers the debate today.
This legislation, in my opinion, did damage to the equality of women in control over their own bodies.
It wasn't a clear-cut victory for abortion rights lawmakers. Days after Schreiber's veto, the legislature passed a more limited bill that included protections for the health of the mother. Schreiber, who said he was personally opposed to abortion, signed it into law.
But in 1978, a coalition of Democrats and Republicans opposed abortion. At this moment in time, the parties were split on abortion throughout the country. Mary Ziegler is a leading expert on the history of abortion in the post-Roe v. Wade era.
The idea that the Republican Party was the party of life, as Ronald Reagan put it, or the anti-abortion party, and the Democrats were supportive of legal abortion wouldn't really coalesce until the early 80s.
That started to change as politicians faced consequences for their stances on abortion.
Sometimes the consequences were personal. Gary Goyke was a Democratic state senator from Oshkosh. He voted for the bill restricting abortion funds, but says the 1978 debate moved him toward a belief in abortion rights. Goyke was Catholic and remembers being confronted at church.
So there, a lady would come sit right in the front row, and at every service that I was at, every mass I was at, she would stand up and say, let us pray that Senator Goyke learns to respect life. And then the parish would say, Lord, hear our prayer, right? And I am sitting right in front. So it was in your face.
For other lawmakers, the issue may have cost them their jobs. When Barbara Lohrmann was first elected as a Republican state senator in 1980, she openly supported abortion access. She says at the time, that wasn't unusual.
You know, almost anybody could fit in either party, frankly.
But by 1994, it was a different story. After the 1990 census, Republicans redrew her state Senate district. It got a lot more conservative.
She drew a primary challenge from Scott Fitzgerald, someone she calls a, quote, darling of the right wing. She says anti-abortion activists threw their weight behind him.
Yeah, those are very devoted, conscientious voters. And like overnight, yard signs went up and down the highway. And I saw that and I thought, uh-oh, this is going to be a problem.
Fitzgerald won the primary. He'd later become the Senate's majority leader and now represents the area in Congress.
For Republicans, the shift toward anti-abortion candidates led to anti-abortion laws. Just a few years after Fitzgerald was elected, he was the lead sponsor of a bill that banned so-called partial birth abortion in Wisconsin.
Democrats were undergoing their own shift toward abortion rights politics. In the 1990 race for attorney general, the Republican incumbent supported overturning Roe v. Wade. His Democratic challenger, Jim Doyle, used it to campaign against him.
That was the number one issue. That's how I got elected. So it really was, it was really always a very important issue to me.
But it would be years before Wisconsin Democrats were once again in any kind of position to change abortion laws.
Their chance came in 2009. Doyle was governor by then. His fellow Democrats had just retaken both chambers of the legislature.
Doyle knew the state's dormant pre-Civil War abortion ban was still on the books, and he knew this could be the chance to get rid of it.
This was certainly an issue, and I wanted to do it, to repeal the old law.
The problem was Democrats had the slimmest of majorities in the Wisconsin Assembly, and when it came to abortion, they didn't really have one at all.
Some anti-abortion Democrats remained in the legislature. Bob Ziegelbauer was one of them.
If they asked me, it would be a short conversation. I just said no.
Ziegelbauer says this was clear to everyone in the Democratic caucus. They knew him, he knew them. They could work together on some issues, but not on abortion.
He says most of the time it was a cordial relationship, until he supported a Republican budget amendment to restrict abortion.
That was the only time I crossed that line, and that line is pretty bright. They don't want you doing that.
After that, Democratic leaders took away Ziegelbauer's committee chairmanship. Soon after, he left the party.
The Democratic majority was short-lived. 2 years later, a Republican wave election gave the party control of the legislature and brought Scott Walker into the governor's office.
I'm pro-life. I've always been pro-life. And I've got a position I think is consistent with many Americans out there.
And Republicans used their power. They pulled state funding from Planned Parenthood. They required patients seeking an abortion to view an ultrasound first. And they passed a 20-week abortion ban.
Anti-abortion victories around the country on the issue culminated last year when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade.
For the abortion rights Democratic Party, it was, in some ways, the worst-case scenario. But strictly politically speaking, it's had a galvanizing effect.
Democratic Governor Tony Evers, who was viewed as vulnerable in his bid for re-election, ran hard on the issue of abortion, and he won.
Holy mackerel, folks, how about that?
Justice Janet Protasiewicz placed abortion rights front and center in her campaign for state Supreme Court earlier this year, and she won.
Well, Wisconsin, guess what? We did it! We did it!
She was sworn in August, giving liberals a majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court for the first time in 15 years.
And that's where things stand now. That state Supreme Court could have the final say on any challenges to Wisconsin's abortion laws. If a pending lawsuit succeeds, the abortion ban could be gone.
Today's Democratic Party is pushing hard for this. But here's the catch. If they get what they want and the ban goes away, that would restore the laws that were passed in the years after Roe.
That means abortion restrictions from the late 70s all the way to the Walker years would be back on the books. And the fight over abortion in post-Roe Wisconsin would go on.
How We Got Here was hosted by Brady Carlson.
And Bridget Bowden. Reporting by Evan Casey, Hope Kerwin, Sarah Lear, Rob Menser, Sean Johnson, Anya Van Wagnendonk, and Gabby Vinnick.
We're produced by Brad Kohlberg. Edited by Kyla Calvert-Mason. Music by Carl Christensen.
Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand and Jenny Peek.
Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols. Special thanks to Peter Bryant, David Hyland, and Noah Ovshinsky.
You can see more at wpr.org/1849.